Good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for joining us tonight. Most definitely, there are people whose crimes of murder are so terrifying, so beyond human comprehension, who are truly degenerate, psychotic killers. And yes, a society should have the right to eliminate those people from within its midst. The problem with the death penalty is that cases like that are very unusual, very few and far between. So many people who are convicted of a capital crime, of capital murder, or in some states, capital rape, and are sentenced to death, are convicted and sentenced on evidence that is arbitrary, capricious, and depends to a great degree on eyewitness accounts, which over and over and over again now has proven to be some of the weakest evidence. So I fully agree that there are people in our society who commit crimes so bad. I don't think Troy Davis is one of those people at all. I have doubts as to his guilt. By the same token, a man was executed in Texas tonight for being part of a murder a few years ago that was just beyond comprehension. Tying to the back of a pickup truck and dragging a man for miles until the man came apart. Is that crime punishable by the death penalty? A rational person would probably say yes, of course. But the problem with the death penalty is that innocent people can be murdered, literally, by the state. This hour is sponsored by Kathleen McCall and her message. I love prayer meeting night on the Mike Malloy Show. Prayer meeting. Yeah, it is Wednesday, isn't it? Thanks, Kathleen. Prayer meeting night on the Malloy Show. Let me tell you, coming up next hour, we're going to be joined by Deborah Berger. She is the co-president of National Nurses United and a practicing registered nurse. You heard me mention or talk about last night a statement issued by National Nurses United about the people at the CNN Republican candidate idiot fest a couple of weeks ago, where when Ron Paul was asked a hypothetical question by Wolf Blitzer about someone no health insurance in a coma, and audience members shrieked out, "Let him die," to lots of whooping and giggling and so on and so forth. And National Nurses United issued a statement about that I shared with you, I think, last night. Well, we are going to be joined by the co-president of National Nurses United tonight, Deborah Berger. And I have something that she wrote that was at thenation.com that I'll share with you a little bit later in the program. But starting things off, Joe in Temecula, California, has an email for us for all the truth seekers tonight. So gather around. Joe writes, "Hi, Mike. Considering that it's church night, I figured I would offer up this log for the campfire, if there's room." Isn't that nice? Is that a metaphor? No, that's not a metaphor. That's not a simile. What's the other one? Metaphor, simile, allusion. I don't know what it is.
Allegory?
No. All right, Prairie 2, send me an email. Tell me what that is. what he said, he's going to offer up a log for the campfire tonight. All right, anyway, he says Jesus would not be welcome in the tea party. Notice he says Jesus, not the Christ. There's a big difference. The right wing, Joe writes, in this country is very fond of trying to say that the United States is a Christian nation and that we were founded on Christian principles. Let's set aside for now the fact that many of the founders were not even Christian and that the Constitution does not set up a national Christian religion. In fact, the Constitution erects a barrier between church and state. That said, an argument could be made that the part of the Constitution which states part of the purpose for obtaining and establishing the Constitution is to promote the general welfare of the people and is in fact emulating in that statement the teachings of Jesus. This is what it says. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Promoting the general welfare of the people is a very Christ-like idea, Joe writes. In fact, if Jesus were to establish a government here on earth, I would imagine a large part of the function of his government would be to help people. You know, to heal the sick, feed the poor, care for those who cannot care for themselves. Taking what Jesus taught, to give up one's possessions, to give to Caesar what is Caesar's, to help the poor, to heal the sick, and to love one's neighbor as oneself, we can surmise that Jesus would not be welcome in the tea party. After all, Jesus did not teach the "let him die" parable the teabaggers are so fond of. Now, I know that many in the tea party do not consider themselves Christian, or if they are religious, do not interject their religion into tea party politics. They have more in common with Ayn Rand, who is an atheist that preached selfishness, or objectivism, as a way of life, than they have in common with Jesus. But today, the formerly identified Christian right social conservatives, led by the likes of Focus on the Family and Pat Robertson, have rebranded themselves as Tea Partiers. They have interjected the pro-life platform into the Tea Party. As such, we would presume the teachings of Jesus would be a big part of the Tea Party doctrine, but they're not. A sad reality of life is that not even Christian social conservatives follow the teachings of Jesus. If Jesus were to ever come back to earth, I can just imagine how it would play out. All the Republican right-wing teabag freaks would invite you to come speak at a rally. Jesus would take to the podium like a rock star offering up his oldies but goodies. It's not the healthy that need a doctor, but the sick. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. It's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. You lack one thing. Go, sell what you own and give the money to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me. And so on and so on. Can you imagine the blank stares Jesus would see from the stage? And if Jesus began to talk about the Good Samaritan stopping to help an injured person on the side of the road, the teabaggers would interrupt him and shout, "Let him die." Jesus would get booed from the stage as he tried to close up his speech with stuff about peace, love, and love for your enemy. On the way out the door, the head Tea Party organizer would tell him to get the hell out and never come back. This is something that has just never made sense to me. If Christians actually believe in the teachings of Jesus and actually practice what Jesus preached, then wouldn't they support programs like food stamps and welfare? Wouldn't they support universal health care and Social Security? Doesn't it make more sense for Christians to embrace the Constitution and use the government to promote the general welfare of the people and, by proxy, the teachings of Jesus? Doesn't it make sense from a perspective of Jesus for wealthy people to pay their taxes and for those taxes to be used to help the poor, the elderly, and the sick? Jesus told people to give up their possessions and give their money to the poor. Does it make sense then for the likes of Pat Robertson and Joel Osteen to have so much goddamn money? Good luck getting into heaven, boys. Joe in Temecula.
It's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. You know, I think tonight we're going to do this early, since we have a guest coming up here in about 45 minutes from Prairie 2. His missive tonight is headlined, "Welcome to the Workers' Paradise of Walmart. I am Comrade Greeter." Oh, no. Prairie 2 writes, "Having committed treason, Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve Board do not dare cross into the Republic of Texas, where they can expect to be treated ugly by the six-gun-a-totin', blue-jean, crotch-adjusting Governor Perry. Congressional Republicans issued a letter to Chairman Bernanke expressing their displeasure as well, but withheld the dime novel cowboy threats. Republicans are desperate to keep anything from being done to benefit the economy, as their only hope for the election is to make things as bad as possible. And even if they begin to question this strategy, their billionaire overlords will not tolerate deviation from their plan. The Fed action is not going to have a huge effect, but will drive consumer interest rates lower, making more people eligible for home loans and such. The current scheme involves selling $400 billion in short-term debt that the Fed holds, and in turn, buy that much in long-term debt, such as the 10-year Treasury notes that is the basis for home mortgage rates. Home loans are already going for less than 4%. The Treasury has been selling new short-term debt at auction that is paying little more than zero interest, and 10-year notes are paying slightly more than 2%. The S&P 500 fell 3%, and this was blamed on the Fed action and their gloomy economic forecast. The real reason the market fell might have something to do with the downgrading of major zombie banks, Bank of America, Citibank, and Wells Fargo, by the Moody's ratings agency or company. This Fed switch-up of Treasury bonds is referred to as Operation Twist. This is because the last time it was tried was in the early 60s, when Chubby Checker's iconic song, "The Twist," was the new dance hit. Too bad that rock and roll didn't last. Do you know Buddy Holly would have been 75 on September 7th? The twist should, in fact, push stocks higher, as the goal is to increase inflation, or more accurately, keep deflation at bay. Conservatives are screaming, "Inflation, inflation! A wheelbarrow of cash for a loaf of bread! Buy gold, buy gold!" By the way, conservatives have gold they will sell you, and gold was down today, as were commodities across the board. The U.S. dollar continues to strengthen, which is not a good thing for exports, but we don't make anything, so it doesn't matter that much. Actual inflation requires wages and prices to be driven up by excess cash in the system. In fact, there are trillions of cash in corporate coffers and in the hands of the super rich, who are hoarding it in the anticipation of the kind of runaway deflation you get in a major depression. If you can buy for 10 cents on the dollar, you too can become a billionaire robber baron like Fred Koch did. Fred came back from setting up Joe Stalin in the oil business in the early 30s with millions in cash from the Grateful Tyrant. And he turned that into hundreds of millions in cash thanks to deflation. After a later falling out with Uncle Joe, Fred started the John Birch Society to rid the U.S. of communists and anybody else he didn't like. The current generation of traders, the Koch brothers, who fund the teabaggers and a whole host of similar operations to undermine democracy, would like to turn their billions into trillions and get rid of us socialists once and for all. Oh, a socialist to them is anybody who isn't a billionaire. Having the entire country owned by giant corporations and controlled by the managerial class is basically how Joe Stalin ran things. He didn't much care for socialists either, despite the propaganda. Do you see the similarity between comrade worker and Walmart associate? Both convey similar ideas of fraternity and have the same reality of slavery. PrairieNumeral2.com. You know, I was talking to my producer today, Kathy, and I said, you know, we have such good contributors, and there's so much good stuff out there on the internet now. You know, stuff close at hand, written by a number of people, some of whom we have used repeatedly on this program, some of whom we know, like Prairie 2, like Bob Alexander, on and on and on. You know who you are. And since all that stuff's available, why do we do any show prep? Why do we do anything? Why don't we just come in, print off six or seven of these excellent essays, and just do that? And Kathy said, isn't that what you do anyway? Well, not quite. But you hate to pass up art, you know what I'm saying? All right, we're going to take a break and come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Before the hour, this hour is sponsored by Kathleen McCall, whose message, I love prayer meeting night on the Mike Malloy Show. Well, thank you, Kathleen. I have an email here from Mark in Manhattan. Proud podcast subscriber. He signs off. If you're not a podcast subscriber, perhaps you would consider that. If you haven't sponsored an hour yet on the program, hopefully you'll consider that. You can go to MikeMalloy.com, and the information there is there on how to do that. The continuation of the program kind of depends on it. And Michael and a couple other people immediately after Michael and Roswell. Yeah, it's a metaphor. Thanks. Thanks, everybody. I just can't keep them straight. Mark in Manhattan. Mike, I've been contemplating for a while now why it is that some people seem to consistently vote against their own best interests and support policies clearly meant to harm them. I simply cannot come up with a rational, psychological, or even moral, quote-quote, reason for why they do this other than to think that they are simply self-delusional. Here's what I mean. Instead of addressing the reality of how far this country has slipped into madness since the so-called election of George W. Bush, those that support the Republicans must be living in a self-imposed bubble, one sustained by our propagandist media, meant to
protect them emotionally from the pain evidenced all around them. What else can it be? Surely teabaggers have elderly sick family members who receive Social Security and Medicare, don't they? Surely teabaggers make, on average, less than $50,000 a year, so why do they support millionaires and billionaires? I believe that's because these individuals simply cannot handle the emotional pain of reality, so they escape into this childish bubble where all is well, good, and Christian. What other reason can there be? If someone was harming me, my family, or even my own selfish interests, I would not support them. If teabaggers and Republicans truly believe in so-called good faith, that their support of these right-wing bastards is going to make their lives better, then when the reckoning comes, it will be a doozy. What happens on that day when the teabaggers finally realize they've been screwed and tattooed, and they themselves are the ones who did it? This is the day that terrifies me the most. You know, Mike, there was a time in the 1930s when all the smart Germans got out. Mark in Manhattan. That's very true. And our guest coming up after the hour is Deborah Berger. She is a registered nurse. She's the co-president of National Nurses United, one of the largest, if not the largest, union and association of nurses in the United States. Recently at The Nation, she wrote the following. I want to share it with you because she's going to join us after the top of the hour. She wrote, "Why did thousands of working nurses and supporters converge on scores of congressional offices from Maine to California last week?" Didn't know about that. Did you? "Why are nurses talking about a Wall Street tax to heal Main Street?" The simple reason is this. We are a nation that is worried sick. It's of epidemic proportions, tied to an economy in free fall for many people and whose bottom is nowhere in sight. We nurses see the effects. We see them during every work shift, every day. It is overwhelming in the hospitals we staff, in our communities, in our own homes. Stress is bending our minds and breaking our bodies. With heart attacks in younger men, a range of gut disorders in people of all ages, severe anxiety even among children, and more. All on the rise. The Wall Street economy is doing us in. I have story after story. One fellow nurse told me of a man in his early 40s arriving at the ER in Minneapolis suffering a heart attack and yet insisting on going back to work without delay. He could not afford to lose pay from his temp job. Nor could he, like growing numbers of Americans, pay for the hospitalization. Patients cannot incur the costs of medicines, report nurses from around the country, with predictable consequences. Among those who must forego their meds are heart transplant patients. Others are forced to put off critical scans or procedures like colonoscopies for cancer patients because of high copays. Mental health care is virtually non-existent for the millions of men, women, and children living on the margins, so they must fend for themselves amidst the crushing consequences of severe emotional trauma. New research from Janet Curry of Princeton and Erdell Tekin of Georgia State asserts a direct correlation between foreclosure rates and health declines in four states. For every 100 foreclosures, there was a 7.2% rise in ER visits and hospitalizations for hypertension, an 8.1% increase for diabetes, and a 12% more visits related to anxiety among 20 to 49-year-olds. We hear the corporate mantra, "We have no confidence in this economy," and it makes us sick. No confidence in a government that cannot act because revenue is gone, used up to bail out financial institutions, the same institutions paying out billions in bonuses again, where tax rates are low and loopholes ubiquitous, to the point where some elites are even saying, "Tax us." No confidence in consumers when wages are flat and 25 million Americans are looking for full-time work. Impoverish tens of millions and then wonder why they don't shop. No confidence in a society holding on to trillions of dollars in an act of cash hoarding of historic proportions, $2 trillion sitting in corporate coffers, yet CEOs paralyzed due to their lack of confidence in America. The same CEOs being paid multi-million dollar salaries to figure out how to unravel their payrolls? Companies with $1.5 trillion in profits overseas unwilling to bring that money back to America without a special tax break? No confidence, say banks, as a way to explain galloping foreclosure rates? The same banks that showed no initiative in following through on promises to assist those same families? To use the bailout money we gave them, they are still holding $500 billion, according to economist Robert Polin. To use the money we gave them to keep people in their homes? And about millions of lost homes. The Princeton, Georgia State study reports a 39% increase in ER admissions for suicide attempted post-foreclosure. No confidence in the richest country in the world by far, where S&P 500 companies averaged 13% return on their money last year. It is enough to make you sick, and that's exactly what's happening. Their so-called lack of confidence is a convenient way to explain the draining of the country's working capital and its low tax revenue, and with it, hope in a future. The elites have no mercy in today's America, as our fundamental state of health, even among our children, takes a back seat to Wall Street's insatiable appetite for a privileged lifestyle. Who, we might ask, will be the first trillionaire? There's a story pitch the national media would invite. A fair and equitable tax system where wealthy corporations and individuals start to pay their share is a start. A Wall Street transaction tax and other nations' versions now exist in 40 countries and at 7 major stock exchanges. A tax was passed by the Parliament of the European Union. Good jobs, retirement, schools, quality health care for all. Let's fund it. That's why thousands of nurses hit the streets in September and asked congressmen and senators in 61 locales support a tax on Wall Street transactions. They can certainly afford it and get the healing of Main Street underway. Without it, this nation of sickness will get much sicker. Ask a nurse. Deborah Berger is a registered nurse and co-president of the California Nurses Association and National Nurses United. And that essay appeared in The Nation online here recently. Now, the reason we're having Deborah on is because tomorrow there's going to be a one-day strike in California. 23,000 nurses will hold a one-day strike tomorrow at 34 Northern and Central California hospitals, saying they will not accept attacks on registered nurse rights to speak out for patients, or cuts in health care, or retiree coverage for nurses or other hospital workers. The walkout affects two of the biggest and wealthiest hospital chains in California, Sutter Health and Kaiser Permanente, as well as Children's Hospital in Oakland. These RNs are members of the California Nurses Association, National Nurses United. So somebody is finally going to do something. And we'll be talking to her in about 20 minutes. We have a break here. We'll come back and chat further. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
And few times a saint, and the quality of mercy is not strange. Yes, for love, if it's love, it's changing but unchanged. And the quality of mercy is not strange.
The quality of mercy is not strained.
Senators and lawyers.
The quality of mercy is not strained.
Victims and heroes.
The quality of mercy is not strained.
Murderers and martyrs. The quality of mercy.
right. From the left, it's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Kathleen McCall, whose message, I love prayer meeting night on the Malloy Show. Thanks, Kathleen. It's a little weird, though, doesn't it, sometimes? It does to me, even. Yeah, it really does. Madness of religion. Prayer meeting. I guess churches still do that, don't they? Again, our guest next hour, the top of next hour, is Deborah Berger, who is one of the, she is the co-president of the California Nurses Association and the National Nurses United. And it's one of the largest, if not the largest, body that represents the nursing profession. And they've had enough. I mean, how many professions outside of the predators that are devouring the country, just dismembering this country? Forget them. But how many, I would imagine the plumbers and pipe fitters feel the same way. I would imagine that doctors, physicians feel the same way. Everything is being driven down to the lowest possible level by the predators. Efforts are made periodically by groups of Americans who are starting to say, no, we can't continue to do this, whether it's in front of the White House or in Lower Manhattan on Wall Street. And you notice how national media has just declared a complete moratorium on what has been going on Wall Street. Nothing. No coverage. Nothing. Unless, of course, something gets out of hand and some provocateur were to throw a Molotov cocktail and set one of those concrete columns on fire. Oh, my goodness. Then media would be all over the place, wouldn't it? Looky, looky, they would start screaming. Anarchists! Look, look! They're setting fire to things! Nurses who work within the Sutter Health System, Sutter Hospital chain in California, are going to be protesting tomorrow. One of the reasons for the general strike tomorrow. They're protesting up to 200 demands for concessions from Sutter Health that the nurses say would, among other concerns, restrict their ability to effectively advocate for patients against the budget-focused priorities of Sutter managers and effectively force nurses to work when they're sick, which would dangerously expose extremely ill patients to infection. Corporate America is a mofo, isn't it? Huh? Capitalism is just absolutely a monster. Additionally, Sutter nurses oppose Sutter management's bid to reduce nurses' health care coverage and retiree health benefits. I mean, these are nurses caring for people within a predatory capitalist system of so-called health care. And that company they work for wants to reduce nurses' health care coverage. I mean, Jesus, Michael and Roswell, is that an example of irony? Or is it insanity? The Sutter Healthcare, or Sutter Health Company nurses are also protesting years of widespread cuts in patient care services that the nurses say have restricted access to needed medical care for thousands of Northern California communities and left a trail of broken promises by Sutter executives. These executives obviously don't give a goddamn. They don't care about their patients. They don't care about their nurses. They don't care about the hospital staff. You know what they care about? Show us the money. What's the bottom line? How much profit we make? Oh, my goodness. Our profit was down 3%. We're only at $3 billion this year instead of $3.3 billion. Well, time to cut. National Nurses United has long challenged the market-based program of cuts in hospital services, and that's one reason Sutter has singled out registered nurses for retaliation. That's according to the California Nurses Association. A nurse at Children's Oakland Hospital, Martha Cool, says, quote, "Nurses will never be silenced in standing up for our patients in our communities or our members and our families," end quote. And at Kaiser Permanente, the RNs are walking out in sympathy to support Kaiser co-workers who are facing management demands for deep cuts in their health coverage and retirement plans. Children's Oakland RNs will be on strike for the third time in a year over what they call punitive management efforts to cut their health coverage, as well with demands that they say would make it prohibitively expensive for nurses to bring their own children to get care at the hospital where they work. Oh, my God. So we're going to talk about this when we come back from this break. And we'll be talking with Deborah Berger, who is co-president of National Nurses United and a practicing registered nurse. So stick around. I think it's very, 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 very important that we, you and I, understand why 23,000 nurses are going to have a one-day strike in California. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. It is 7 past the hour. Right before the break, we were talking about 23,000 nurses are going to strike tomorrow. One day, a walkout in California in response to a number of issues. And joining us now is Deborah Berger, whose piece in The Nation I shared with you a few minutes ago. Deborah Berger is the is a registered nurse and co-president of the California Nurses Association and National Nurses United. Deborah, thanks for sitting in here for a while. In a succinct way, what is the strike all about tomorrow?
Well, there's several issues because there's several different strikes. There's the Sutter nurses who have been without a contract from anywhere from 12 months, who've been negotiating in good faith to try and come to a resolution. There are children's nurses that work at Children's Hospital in California that have also been without a contract for over a year. And then there are the Kaiser nurses, which is one of the larger contingents of 17,000 nurses that are striking in sympathy with their co-workers who are facing massive takeaways on health care benefits and post-retirement medical care and pension take elimination of a defined pension plan.
Now, these are nurses who work for corporate America. These are not nurses that work, or are they nurses that work in the so-called public sector?
They are nurses that work for what they call nonprofit hospitals in California, which, by the way, do make money. Mm-hmm. Kaiser, within the last 2 years, has made $5.1 billion. Sutter Corporation has made over $10 billion. I think it's something like $9.1 billion over the last 5 years. And Children's Hospital, which is also a nonprofit, has made substantial profits as well. And the number eludes me at this point, but it is a large amount of money. So even though they're nonprofits, they're still making money. And they're still asking for significant takeaways, even though they are not suffering, and neither are their CEOs.
For people listening like me, can you explain what, I mean, a nonprofit that winds up with a profit of $10 billion, I don't understand that. How does that work?
It's because of all of the corporate loopholes and because of the way these hospitals are structured. They get laws written mm-hmm. that allow them to incorporate and be what they call nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
But they still make money, and they have to figure out a way to distribute it. So what they do is they put the money back into buildings. They put the money back into employees and in training and things like that. They do a minimal amount of what we would call charity care. But then they can still give money to their CEOs and to physicians and to consultants and attorneys and still write that off as the ability to do business. When you and I buy a contractor to fix up our home, we can't write that off as a business deduction.
Mm-hmm.
But because they're organized as a nonprofit, whenever they build a building or they give money to their CEOs, they get to write it off and don't pay taxes on it.
It's my understanding that, this is from, I believe this is from the CNA. It says Children's Oakland registered nurses will be on strike for the third time in a year over what they call punitive management efforts to cut their health coverage, to cut nurses' health coverage?
Exactly.
Is this not some kind of a very twisted, sick irony?
Well, it is. You are exactly right. And most of the public understands that. We, are, as nurses and other healthcare workers, provide care for our patients. And what Children's Hospital and Sutter Hospital and Kaiser are proposing is that even though you work at that facility, you may not be able to afford care to get your care at that facility. And what's even worse is that nurses and healthcare workers, as a result of the work they do, are exposed to communicable diseases mm-hmm. and other hazards on the job, such as HIV, hepatitis, and other bacterial infections, meningitis, all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we wouldn't be able to get care at our own facilities. We have nurses at Children's Hospital that could not take their children to doctors that are affiliated with Children's Hospital or be hospitalized at Children's Hospital.
I just find that bordering on, some sort of societal insanity. I can't get my mind around that.
It's sad. And it's terribly egregious, but it's not happening just to Children's nurses. It's happening to Sutter nurses right now. and it's happening to the Kaiser healthcare workers and the pharmacists who have signed agreements, but what we're concerned about is that it's happening nationwide. You're working for a healthcare corporation, you're working for a doctor, you're working for a hospital, you're working in the community in public service, and you don't have health access to healthcare. And that's why we have our Main Street contract for the American people, because there are unionized workers that still manage to have a health plan, still manage to have a post-retirement health care, manage to have a pension, and we think everyone should be able to have that. Mm-hmm. And somehow it's been flipped so that if the haves have it, it should be taken away because nobody else has it. And we're saying everyone should have it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone should feel secure that they could go into a doctor's office, that they could go into a hospital and get the life-saving treatment that they need and not end up in bankruptcy or lose their home or be in debt for 50 or 60 years, because some of the bills that our patients are facing right now would mean that somebody would have to work for the next 50 or 100 years just to pay the medical benefit. And it's wrong.
Yeah. It's also insane. There are a couple of quotes here, one from a Sharon Tobin, RN at Sutter Mills Peninsula in Burlingame, California, says, quote, "We staunchly refuse to be silenced on patient care protections. A common theme," the quote goes on, "throughout management's proposals is removing our presence on committees that address important patient care issues and nursing practices. As nurses, we speak up. And we insist on standards that safeguard our patients. But Sutter doesn't want to hear about anything that might cut into their huge profits." Now, that, I guess, in a rational society, which I have a feeling we no longer live in a rational society, that would be a fairly strong charge, almost up to and including a dereliction of duty where it concerns, you know, if you say you're a hospital or a Kaiser Permanente or whatever you are, and you're saying, okay, our primary concern here is healthcare, and then you refuse to put on committees patient advocates, that seems like, it seems almost criminal. And I'd like to address that when we come back. I got to take a break here, Deborah. Can you hold on?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll come back and talk further with Deborah Berger. She is the president of the California Nurses Association. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
For making it through school without you, thought you wanted a little piece of mind, and you didn't know how to make it. We thought you were already fine, and you don't have to
Progressive Talk. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. We're talking with Deborah Berger, who is the president of the California Nurses Association, about a one-day general strike tomorrow. 23,000 nurses in California to make their point about speaking out for patients' rights and the right to advocate for patient care by registered nurses. That question, or the statement made by Sharon Tobin, where nurses demand the right to speak out on behalf of standards that safeguard patients, and that they, the nurses are being removed from or denied access to these committees, is what is the point in that?
Well, the issue is that over the last 5 decades, nurses have struggled to develop committees that are not dominated by management and administrators, so that when nurses see and identify patient safety issues, they can bring these up without being censored, without being blackballed, without being intimidated, and really identify solutions that will help improve patient safety. And the hospitals don't like these committees because sometimes it's really uncomfortable, especially in the case of hospital chains that rely on doctors that are in private practice. And some of those physicians may not be appropriate for providing safe patient care, or even identifying sometimes their own colleagues or hospital procedures that they believe are unsafe. And so over the last five decades, we've developed committees where nurses can come in and have a systems look at these and really take care of the issue. And right now, Sutter is proposing to get rid of these committees that are decades old, that have been proven to improve patient safety, and allow nurses to speak up on behalf of their patients. So that really is the issue at the Sutter facilities at this point, as well as Children's Hospital.
Two quick questions here, Deborah. Will patient care in these hospitals be jeopardized with the walkout tomorrow? A. B. How effective, where it concerns management, do you think this general strike will be? Both questions.
Well, the reality is that we have given, we're legally required to give a 10-day notice at any facility that registered nurses are planning on striking. In most cases, we've given at least 10 days, and in Kaiser's case, 14 days. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but they've heard and seen our flyers out there saying that we're planning on a strike and nurses need to get ready. So the Sutter, Kaiser, and Children's have been canceling elective surgeries. They've been making arrangements for temporary workers. In the case of Kaiser, they're making arrangements for a one-day replacement of the workers. In Sutter's case and in Children's case, they're making arrangements for 6 and 7 days as a punitive measure to the nurses that walked out to protect patients.
Wow. And we have just a minute left here, Deborah. How effective do you think this walkout will be?
I think it's extremely effective because the nurses are totally committed to protecting patients and making sure that patients come first in their world. Mm-hmm. And I believe that we will be ultimately successful in making sure that we preserve these committees, that we preserve sick time so nurses can be off and not exposing patients to communicable diseases. Mm-hmm. So nurses are going to be out there tomorrow on behalf of their patients.
Deborah Berger, who is the president of California Nurses Association, thanks a lot, Deborah. We will take very close notice of what happens tomorrow. I know I certainly am, in spirit anyway, totally behind what you and the other 23,000 nurses in California are trying to do. Thanks a lot for taking time to talk with us, okay?
Okay, and just check our website. You can join any one of the picket lines.
And the website is?
www.calnurses.org.
Calnurses.org.
Exactly. Right.
Deborah, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a break. The Supreme Court has denied that stay of execution for Troy Davis. So Troy Davis will probably be executed here in Georgia momentarily. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend.
25 before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by John Means.
We're on the eve of destruction.
You can visit johnneems.com. That's John, J-O-H-N, N-I-E-M-S, johnneems.com, for excellent original music inspired by Bush-era political events. And John's message, 9/11 was the most obvious false flag in history. Why? It was on TV. The script was written well in advance, and the patsies like Lee Harvey Oswald were chosen well in advance. John, thanks for the sponsorship. And go to his website, johnneems.com, J-O-H-N-N-I-E-M-S, johnneems.com, for excellent original music inspired by Bush-era political events. The Supreme Court has lifted its reprieve and refused to hear argument in favor of a stay of execution for Troy Davis here in Georgia. He will be executed within the next 20 minutes. This after liberals and conservatives, the former warden of the very prison where he is to be executed, has asked the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles to stop this. Right-wing former federal prosecutor Bob Barr has asked that this execution be stopped. Wardens in prisons execute prisoners, wardens in prisons in seven states, have asked the Georgia Pardons and Paroles Board to stop this because there is so much doubt about the guilt or innocence of Troy Davis. And no one in a position to do so is going to do it. Nobody. Phone number here is 877-996-2556. I'm not sure how to discuss that. I've been down this road so many times with so many cases. Like I said at the beginning of the program tonight, there are instances where the commission of a murder is done with such horrific elements, would that be the right word, circumstances, and there is no question about the guilt of the perpetrator, none whatsoever. DNA evidence, whatever. No doubt, none. The case against the person who commits the murder is ironclad. And he, and very seldom she, let's stick with the he is convicted and sentenced to death. And eventually, after a long drawn-out process, is executed. And I think most people, at least privately, can agree to themselves that there are situations that seem to warrant execution. I don't know. I don't know how a rational society deals with those kinds of murders. I just don't. There is a case now. Is it where is it? Kathy, in Massachusetts, the physician whose home was invaded a couple of years ago, his wife and two daughters were murdered. The 11-year-old daughter was forced to perform oral sex before she was tied to her bed, and the house set on fire. One of the perpetrators has been convicted and sentenced to death. The second perpetrator is now on trial. And there's a case in Texas tonight. A man was executed, the man that dragged another man behind his pickup truck for miles until the person being dragged came apart. The driver was a white person identified by prosecutors as a racist psychopath. The victim was black. In that instance, would anyone doubt that if the death penalty were to be applied, those two instances I just mentioned would be perfect candidates for the death penalty, for execution? And again, so many times people are convicted and sentenced to death when the evidence is not that clear. Where there is doubt. There is probably doubt in 95% of capital cases. Just enough doubt. That's why I think the law says beyond a reasonable doubt. What is a reasonable doubt? I mean, what does that definition mean? And I'm sure legal scholars have been wrestling with that one for decades. But overarching all of this is the question of whether or not a civilized society should have a death penalty, where the state is given power to execute its own citizens. Now, that argument rings hollow to me right now, and probably for a long time, certainly before I even started paying attention to what U.S. foreign policy and U.S. domestic policy really consisted of. We execute people by the thousands who are not even citizens of the United States, don't live here. Halfway around the world, we execute them with bombs. We execute them with drone aircraft fired missiles. We execute thousands of people every year. And sometimes when we go on a real rampage, like we did during the Bush crime family era, we execute hundreds of thousands of innocent people with no mercy, not even any acknowledgement. Just, we don't do body counts. Well, sorry, you know, we're involved in a war on terror. Sorry, you know, we didn't mean to butcher all those women and children, but that's the way it goes. Those women and children should not be in a house where we are convinced there are terrorists. So to argue against the death penalty, even though you may be against it, as I am, to argue against the death penalty in a society that executes people on an ongoing basis who are not even in this country is insanity producing, isn't it? Matt is in St. Louis, listening on Sirius. Hello, Matt.
How you doing, Mike?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm enjoying your show. You know, I'm against the death penalty myself. My wife is for it, and we've been debating this for the last few days. And I keep coming to the one point that the death penalty and execution is more about revenge than the law or justice. And I don't hear that from anybody.
Well, I would disagree with that, Matt. I you may be right. You may be entirely right. And the discussion you and your wife have had, I've had the discussion with people too. But the law is supposed to remove the element of revenge. That's why it's a jury trial. In some societies, someone who is accused of murdering someone else is turned over. That person's turned over to the family of the victim to do with them as they want. That is a revenge, and usually that person is then immediately murdered. That is revenge, purely and simply. But isn't it true that's why it usually takes anywhere from 5 to 25 years for an execution to be carried out, is because it's not about revenge. Allegedly, what it's about, at least as far as the state is concerned, the state has no emotional interest in executing a prisoner. Now, the family, this family that tonight will witness this execution of Troy Davis, they have an emotional stake in it. To them, even though they deny it, it may be about revenge. And I guess that is an emotion that would be difficult to say is invalid. Years ago, when I came out against the death penalty, And my son Chris at the time was 5 years old. I used to get calls from people who say, what would happen if somebody would brutally murder your child? Would you be against the death penalty then? And my answer was very confused and a little bit maybe dodging that question. My answer was, I don't think if somebody killed my son, my five-year-old, I don't think that they would make it to trial because I would try to find them and kill them myself. Now, that's revenge. That is emotion. And that's what the law is supposed to do. It's supposed to take the emotion out of it, where a jury will listen to the evidence that's being presented and make a decision based on that evidence. Now, that's all well and good, except in a case like Troy Davis's, where the only evidence presented was the evidence of eyewitnesses. There was no DNA, there was no weapon, there was no motive, there was no ballistic evidence. It was only the evidence of nine eyewitnesses, seven of whom who have now recanted and said they were coerced or forced or threatened to give that kind of testimony. And that's the problem that we're facing here. I got to leave it there. Thanks, Matt. I appreciate you checking in.
He's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by John Neames. Go to johnneames.com. That's J-O-H-N-N-I-E-M-S. johnneames.com for excellent original music inspired by Bush-era political events. And John's message, 9/11 was the most obvious false flag in history. Why? It was on TV. The script was written well in advance, and the patsies like Lee Harvey Oswald were chosen well in advance. John, thanks for the sponsorship. We do appreciate it. Mike is in Burlington, Iowa. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, hi. The one thing, Mike, I hadn't heard anybody talk about after the Republican debate with the let him die thing about the guy who didn't have any insurance if he ended up in a coma was... nobody seemed to remember the name Terry Schiavo.
Right.
And you know how the Republican right wing had gone on for, what, over a year?
It was horrible.
They brought Congress back in to pass a law supposedly to save her.
Bush interrupted his vacation.
Yeah.
Right.
And I mean...
well, Republicans are vermin. I mean, they are hell-bent on destroying the country. They will, in one instance, say everything is white. In the next instance, the same thing will be declared black. The next instance, it will be declared to be invisible. So it depends on what will fit their particular agenda in any given moment. And that is the kind of governance that guarantees that eventually the republic will fall.
Is there no Edward R. Murrow out there to come and save us? Because Wolf Blitzer certainly didn't.
Well, no. Blitzer is not going to point out the idiocy of what was being talked about or how the audience was reacting. I think one of the reasons is because Blitzer understands that the people in the audience would have ripped him to pieces given, given any provocation whatsoever. And then, you know, you can't, I don't know how many people were in that hall, but if there were, let's say, 1,000 people and they decided to shred Wolf Blitzer, who is the state going to convict?
Oh, yeah.
So so I think with Blitzer, as a matter of self-preservation, just let it go. And I will guarantee you, well, you saw it. No, not one of those vermin that were on stage, those Republican candidates, had the courage to say, wait a second, that's not the kind of attitude that makes for good governance. And the reason they didn't say anything is because that's the kind of attitude that they all share. So it doesn't matter when that kind of a statement is made. It doesn't matter. Republicans are slowly destroying the country, and the rest of us are just sitting back on our asses letting it happen. And it's just astonishing to me.
And you had physician Ron Paul coming out with, there's too much licensing in medicine. I think I want to be the guy that does the surgery on Ron Paul.
Right.
You know.
All right, Mike, thanks. I appreciate you checking in. Take care. Jeremy's in Burlington, Vermont. Hello, Jeremy.
Hi, Mike. Didn't you mention the other night that Troy Davis is a black man?
Yeah.
Well, there's no surprise why he's dying tonight then.
Well, the victim was white, and in case after case, it's been proven statistically over and over and over again that whoever, black or white, whoever takes the life of a white person stands by a factor of 5, 10, 15, pick a number, of being executed. Whoever takes the life of a black man, a black person, the race of the killer, regardless, that person has less of a chance of far less of a chance being executed. The bottom line explanation is that white life is still regarded in much more highly than black life in this country.
Well, yeah, generally there's another saying that says if a white cop is killed, they'll have to kill it the next day. If a black person's killed, they won't have someone for years. Unfortunately.
Right. Right.
Similar to that, yeah.
Yeah, like I said, there have been study after study done that shows that the application of the death penalty in this country is ludicrous. That's what makes it ineffective. It does not deter capital murder. It does not, the right-wingers say, well, the person that committed that murder and gets hanged will never commit another one. Well, that's childlike thinking. That's what a six-year-old would say. So, we're in a terrible situation here on so many levels because we have this major political party that media is sucking up to like nothing I've ever seen, that is hell-bent on destroying the country, whether it is our criminal justice system, which is what this execution contributes to, whether it's our education system, whether it's our just pick anything. And the right wing is utterly and absolutely destroying it. And again, like I said, the last caller in Burlington, Iowa, most of us are sitting back on our asses not doing anything and just letting it happen. I don't know what it's going to take to inspire us to bring this to a halt, but I feel it coming, if you know what I mean, Jeremy. I just feel something coming.
Yeah, one last quick thing. If anyone has the information on this case, it's Obama. He has control of the Justice Department, and he sat back and will not say a goddamn thing about this.
Well, I heard that earlier today, and his press spokesman said, look, there's nothing we can do because it's a state case. That's not true.
He can extend clemency
to
anyone he wants.
That's true. He can. And there are other things that Obama could have done, but Obama decided that this is a state issue and he's not going to get involved, which is... I don't know. If you look at Barack Obama's record over the past 2.5 years, that's pretty much what he does. He doesn't get involved when people are being brutalized by state governments, when public employees are being brutalized, when someone convicted of murder is about to be executed, when it becomes fairly apparent that the conviction was shaky to begin with, and now the witnesses are recanting. This is a president who doesn't get his hands dirty, if you know what I mean. Jeremy, I got to leave it there. Thanks. I appreciate what you had to say. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. 7 past the hour. You remember, I'm sure you do, all the arrests in front of the White House protesting the XL pipeline. The pipeline that's going to bring toxic tar sands oil from Canada to the United States. Nearly 1,300 Americans were arrested, and I believe that they represented Americans from nearly all 50 states. None of this, of course, made the least bit of impression that we're aware of on Barack Obama or his administration or his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. Secretary of State, I believe, has already signed off on this, or I believe the EPA has already signed off on it. Oh, no, everything will be fine, is what they're saying. You know, I'm not going to rehash all of the issues involved here. I'll let somebody else do it for me. But, and I'll get to that in a second. But almost 1,300 Americans were willing to go to jail and did go to jail over this issue. It's yet one more shocking to me, apparently not to a lot of other so-called liberal or progressive talk show hosts, but shocking example to me of the utter betrayal being perpetrated by Barack Obama on the Democrats. Liberals, progressives, young people who voted for him the last time. And I just don't know how much longer. Look, let me put it this way. On the one hand, you have these psychotic Republicans accusing him of everything, of not being an American citizen, to, helping the Palestinians overthrow the government of Israel. I mean, right-wingers, the Republicans, the teabaggers, they are insane. They're goddamn freaks who hate the country, hate Obama, will do anything to destroy him on the basis of their personal hatred for him. Those of us on the real left who say, look, this president is not behaving the way a liberal or a progressive should behave, are coming at this from an entirely different direction, a policy direction. And I hope that those on the left, and we are few in number, will continue to do what this president, I seem to remember, said. Oh, you got to hold my feet to the fire. Okay. Okay. I think Mr. Obama should keep in mind how difficult it's going to be to try to mobilize in the 2012 campaign that part of his, you know, what you assume would be his base, the environmental activists. They're damn sure not the base of the Republican Party. Jesus, no. And in particular, in that base, young people. How difficult it's going to be to get young folks, volunteers, to knock on thousands of doors, put in those long days that are necessary in a campaign, free, to donate money if they don't think the president is showing the courage to stand up to big polluters. How's that going to happen, huh? That's what Mike Bruhn, the executive director of the Sierra Club, told the New York Times in a recent article. How are you going to ask people, especially young people, whose very lives, whose futures depend on what this president does now? How are you going to ask them to volunteer to work for this man for another 4 years if he's going to just stab him right in the back by signing off on allowing this tar sands pipeline to go through? Well, you're not. And anyone in the president's council of advisors who thinks that these people will continue to work for him, you're crazy. You're crazy out of your minds. In today's New York Times, page A19, 9 Nobel Peace Laureates, of which Barack Obama happens to be one. 9 Nobel Peace Laureates, including the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, two religious figures, how about that, are calling on President Obama to stop the pipeline. Here's their letter. Dear President Obama, We, a group of Nobel Peace laureates, are writing today to ask you to do the right thing for our environment and reject the proposal to build the Keystone XL, a 1,700-mile pipeline that would stretch from Canada's Alberta tar sands to the Texas Gulf Coast. The night you were nominated for president, you told the world that under your leadership and working together, the rise of the oceans will begin to slow and the planet will begin to heal. You smile. You know, I just got to say, that just sounds so goddamn stupid now, doesn't it? Doesn't that sound like just wonderful poetry coming from Mr. Obama? What has he done to fulfill that poetic statement? But I digress. You spoke of creating a clean energy economy. This is a critical moment to make good on that pledge and make a lasting contribution to the health and well-being of everyone on this planet. In asking you to make this decision, we recognize the more than 1,200 Americans who risked arrest to protest in front of the White House between August 20th and September 3rd. Those brave individuals have spoken movingly about experiencing the power of nonviolence in facing authority. They represent millions of people whose lives and livelihoods will be affected by construction and operation of the pipeline in Alberta, Montana, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. All along its prospective route, the pipeline endangers farms, wildlife, and precious water aquifers, including the Ogallala Aquifer, the U.S.'s main source of freshwater for America's heartland. We are aware that Nebraska's Governor Dave Heineman, as well as two Nebraska senators, has urged you to reconsider the pathway of the pipeline. In his letter to you, the governor clearly stated his concern about the threat to this crucial water source for Nebraska's farmers and ranchers. And the aquifer supplies drinking water to 2 million people in Nebraska and seven other states. We know that another pipeline that covers some of the same route as the proposed pipeline and built by the same company proposing to build Keystone XL already has leaked 14 times over its first year of operation. Like you, we understand that strip mining and drilling tar sands from under Alberta's boreal forests and then transporting thousands of barrels of oil a day from Canada through to Texas will not only hurt people in the U.S., but will also endanger the entire planet. After the oil fields of Saudi Arabia, the full development of the Alberta tar sands will create the world's second largest potential source of global warming gases. As NASA climatologist James Hansen has said, this is, quote, essentially game over for the climate, end quote. Your rejection of the pipeline provides a tremendous opportunity to begin transition away from our dependence on oil, coal, and gas, and instead increase investments in renewable energies and energy efficiency. We urge you to say no to the plan proposed by the Canadian-based company TransCanada to build the Keystone XL and to turn your attention back to supporting renewable sources of energy and clean transportation solutions. This will be your legacy to Americans and the global community, energy that sustains the lives and livelihoods of future generations. Sincerely, and then the signature of 9 Nobel Peace Laureates, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the 14th Dalai Lama. Now, if you want to add your voice to this, you can. Go to stoptar.org and sign the petition. Stoptar.org. Just unbelievable. I mean, it's just mind-boggling what this president is doing. On your own. Well, I sat there at the table. She danced around the barroom, and she did the hoochie-coo. Yeah, she sang her song on that
no abuse.
21 past the hour. Or as my English teacher used to say to me, 21, not 20, 20, 21 past. Thank you. Obama was at the UN this morning, as you know, and he said that the only way to achieve the goal of peace in the Middle East is through a resumption of direct negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel. Mr. Obama said he applauded the struggles for freedom and democratic rights by the people of Tunisia, Egypt, Syria, and Libya to overthrow decades of autocratic rule. But he also said that the plan by the Palestinian Authority to seek full UN membership as a state was not the path for resolving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Obama said in his speech, "Peace is hard." He said, quote, "Peace will not come through statements and resolutions at the United Nations. If it were that easy, it would have been accomplished by now." End quote. I wonder if the president understands the irony of that statement. I'm sure he does. He is not a stupid man by any means. He's an expert on history and therefore should be an expert on international relations. But to make a statement that peace will not come through statements and resolutions at the UN, if it were that easy, it would have been accomplished by now. Does he understand the number of times that Israel has violated UN resolutions, has, worse than violated, has ignored UN resolutions over the past 40 years? If he's aware of that, then surely he was being ironic in his statement. He would have had to be ironic, because if he's not being ironic, then he's acting like somebody who is totally unaware of the violations, repeated violations by Israel of UN resolution after UN resolution. Ultimately, the president said, it is Israelis and Palestinians who must live side by side. You know, that is so true. And you would think, you know, once again, is it not ironic? Surely he is using irony here in its most useful form, because Israelis and Palestinians living side by side has been something that U.S. governments, since Harry Truman, have refused to demand. In fact, what the U.S. governments, going all the way back to Truman, what U.S. governments have done is side almost exclusively with the Israelis. One of the reasons that we are in so much turmoil in the Middle East has been unbridled, unqualified support by the United States, government after government, Democrat after Republican, for Israel at the expense of the Palestinian people. For the most part, so many Palestinians have been living in refugee camps since 1948. 90% of my audience wasn't alive in 1948. Okay, 60%. You know, to say once again, as I've been saying since the 80s, since the 1980s, that the treatment of the Palestinian people is something that is an outrage and closely parallels the treatment of the Jews by the Germans in the lead up to the Holocaust. That is not an overstatement. It is an observation. It's based on the reality that the Palestinian people have to deal with. There are certain segments of the Israeli government, most notably the Likud, who will tell you that there's no such thing as Palestinian people, because there's no such thing as Palestine. It doesn't exist. which once again closely parallels what the Jews have been told for hundreds of years. It's just it's a complete outrage. Sephardic Jews and the Palestinians are the only difference between them is a tribal difference, part of which is based in religion. They are all Semitic people. I say Sephardic because the Ashkenazi are not Middle Eastern Jews. So all this talk about anti-Semitism, anytime you bring this issue up, is ludicrous. What a person leveling the charge of anti-Semitism should say is you are being anti-Jewish. But they don't say that, do they? That's too blatant. That's too right out in your face. So Mr. Obama is talking about peace in the Middle East. Peace is hard. Yeah, it is. We'll be right back.
It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. A little bit more on what Obama said at the UN today, explaining why he will not support, or the United States will not support, this bid by the Palestinians for statehood being sought through the UN Security Council. He said, quote, "We seek a future where Palestinians live in a sovereign state of their own with no limit to what they can achieve." There is no question that the Palestinians have seen that vision delayed for too long. And it's precisely because we believe so strongly in the aspirations of the Palestinian people that America has invested so much time and effort in the building of a Palestinian state and the negotiations that can achieve one. End quote. And according to published reports, the General Assembly listened quietly to Obama's speech. There was no cheering and yelling and agreement. In the meantime, while President Obama is bending once again to the demands of the Israelis, especially to the Likud, to Netanyahu, in the meantime, I just wonder to what extent, I know a lot of people are, but to what extent people are aware that a foreign government is allowed access to U.S. foreign policy decisions and decisions made within our legislative branch. Israel now has more, Netanyahu has more influence in the U.S. House of Representatives than does President Obama. Are you aware of that? Are you aware of that? Let me give you an example, a report by the New York Times. Last month, the Obama administration wanted to be certain that Congress would not block $50 million in new aid to the Palestinian Authority. So in order to make sure that the U.S. Congress would not block that expenditure, that aid, the Obama administration went to a very influential lobbyist around this issue, Israel's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. That's who Obama had to go to in order to convince the Republican death stranglehold on the U.S. Congress to go along, or the U.S. House to go along with this appropriation of funds to the Palestinians. At the request of the American embassy in Israel, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Netanyahu got on the phone and urged dozens of members of Congress not to object to the aid. That's according to congressional and diplomatic officials. Netanyahu's intervention with Congress underscores, as the Times points out, the extraordinary intersection of American diplomacy and domestic politics. And this relationship that's getting worse and worse between the Israeli government and the Republican Party that now controls the House of Representatives. This is just a goddamn outrage. I mean, if it were the British Parliament that had this much influence, if Obama needed to get something done and had to turn to the British Prime Minister to address members of our legislative branch to get it done. I mean, what the hell? What is this? And as I reported to you yesterday, Rick Perry delivered one of his half-assed speeches in New York, criticizing Obama's stance toward Israel as naive, arrogant, misguided, and dangerous. Now, that shows a couple things. First of all, Rick Perry is really a slimy, slimy, filthy Republican. I know, I repeat myself. But none of that is true. None of it. Obama, I mean, just the opposite. You could say that his relationship with the Palestinians has been naive, arrogant, misguided, and dangerous. But you see, Perry is there to suck up to American Jews to get money and to try to drive a wedge. Jewish voters traditionally, historically, have voted Democratic. Except in this New York congressional district that Anthony Weiner had to vacate because of his juvenile horse crap. And Orthodox Jews pushed the election of that district in favor of Republicans because the Republican did exactly what Perry's doing, pandering, pandering, pandering. And to Orthodox Jews, I don't care where they live, somebody with the name Barack Hussein Obama, oh, please. So anyway, Perry is in New York yesterday with those kinds of statements. And Perry also said he would soon be a guest of Danny Danone. Am I pronouncing it right? He's the hard right deputy speaker of the Israeli parliament. That's Glenn Beck's good buddy, too. When Glenn Beck wants to address the Israeli parliament, because he's a psychopathic American Mormon, Christian, whatever the hell he is, he goes to Danny Danone to get permission to address. I mean, this is insane. This is totally, totally insane. The relationship between the Israeli government and the Republican Party, according to the Times, has significantly complicated Obama's administration diplomatic efforts to avert a confrontation at the United Nations this week over that bid by the Palestinians for full membership as a state. So what has happened here? The Republicans, never forgetting their prime directive to make Obama a one-term president, they don't give a goddamn. Republicans couldn't care less about the United States, couldn't care less about the slaughter going on in the Middle East, don't give a rat's ass about any of this stuff. What Republicans are doing are making their final push to get control of the White House, get control of the Senate, and turn this country into a total corporatist state. This is what they're paid to do. This is their goal, because all Republicans hate America, hate it down to its core, and are seeking to destroy it. And their elected representatives of these Republicans have the opportunity to do just that. So to pander to the Israelis, knowing full well, and the Republicans know this, the Israelis know it, American Jews know this. What the hell is wrong with you? I keep saying this over and over again to the American Jews who support these monsters, these Republicans. They will kill you. They will destroy you. They are worse than the Inquisition of the 15th century. They will destroy you. Do you not understand that? I'm sure you do. What is wrong with you, American Jews? What is wrong with you? Have you lost your minds? Lay down with dogs, get up with fleas. These are Republicans. These are Christian fundamentalists. These are the kind of people who sent 6 million to the death chambers. What is wrong with you? Man. One of the members of Congress who attended the meeting with Netanyahu back in August, when Obama had to turn to the Israeli Prime Minister to get American legislation approved or not objected to by these filthy Republicans, Representative Michael Grimm, a Republican in New York, said that it was carefully explained to the delegation by Netanyahu that the money would be used for training Palestinian police officers who work closely with the Israeli government. Good little Palestinians. As back in this country, back in before the civil rights movement, we had good house Negroes who would do exactly what the white power establishment told them to do, right? Same thing. Congressman Grimm said he felt more comfortable receiving the explanation from the Israeli Prime Minister than from Barack Obama. Son of a bitch. Do you understand this, truth seeker? Do you understand what this representative, Michael Grimm, is saying? That it is perfectly okay for him. As a matter of fact, it is necessary for him to hear an explanation from a foreign head of state rather than his own president. Now, what do you call that? I call it treason. I call this scum-sucking Grimm a traitor, just like I call every single Republican office holder a complete traitor involved in treason against the United States. My God. And then, of course, the Time points out that the Republicans see the relationship with the Israeli government as an opportunity. Mindful of Mr. Obama's strained relationship with Mr. Netanyahu and emboldened by a special election victory last week in a heavily Jewish congressional district in New York, the Times goes on, Republicans hope the tensions between Mr. Obama and Israel will help propel future political victories for the Republicans here. Do you understand what is going on? What do you call that? If you don't call that treason against the United States, then treason against the United States does not exist.
Losing hope is easy.
Before the hour. So again, what do you call it when a political party in the United States has made it very clear that they will listen regarding certain issues? They will listen to a foreign head of state where it concerns their decisions legislatively back here in the U.S. They'll listen to a foreign head of state before they'll listen to the president of the United States. Now, again, we're not asking, wrong pronoun. What is not being asked here is that Republicans agree with the President of the United States. No more than you necessarily ask Democrats to agree with a Republican President of the United States. The issue here is that the power now wielded by the Prime Minister of Israel over the Republican Party in this country is it contravenes everything that should matter to anybody where it concerns the Constitution of the United States. To allow a foreign power to make the decisions for members of the U.S. Congress, does this not register? Is nobody aware of what I'm saying here? Is it not obvious, especially when you have some obscene idiot like Rick Perry standing surrounded by American Jews and Israeli Jews and saying that the Obama's attitude toward Israel or his stance toward Israel is naive, arrogant, misguided, and dangerous? And again, I asked this yesterday, what is it with American Jews and Israeli Jews? Are you really embracing Rick Perry? Are you serious? And I realize it's only a small percentage, but why is it even one prominent American Jew who stands next to Rick Perry as he makes these kinds of statements? Rick Perry. I mean, hello, American Jews. Let me tell you something in case you missed it. This is a guy who a couple of months ago, before he announced that he was going to run for the presidency, had a huge prayer meeting down in Texas. And my dear American Jewish friends, are you aware of the people he invited to speak and what their religious slash fascist slash political point of view is concerning you? Are you totally unaware of these Christian dominionists, these Christian fundamentalists in this country who are using you, I guess, in much the same way you're using them? Who do you think is going to win in this vile, nasty relationship between American Jews, Israeli Jews, and these American Christian fundamentalists, these dominionists? Who do you think eventually is going to win? And why are you doing this? These are people who are not the least bit hesitant in explaining to anyone who wants to hear what the Christian Bible says. That when their Messiah, the one that you Jews rejected and murdered, that's how it's presented. Oh, Vatican II, I don't even want to hear about it. When they absolve the Jews of responsibility, when the Catholics absolve the Jews, please. These Christian fundamentalists have no truck with the Catholics anyway. But what, when these dominionists explain to their flocks, these sheep, and the term flock is a good one, when these dominionist pastors, these televangelists, these people at the mega churches, the ones who turn out books and tracts and lessons about where the Christian faith is going, what the expectation is, what the ultimate result will be. Are American Jews, are you not aware of this? That they, that you American Jews, you are still forever the devil. Don't you get that? But in their great compassion, these evangelicals, these dominionists like Rick Perry, are going to grant you when their Savior returns. And I realize this is all hog snot, but all religion is hog snot. So there you stand, American Jews, with an American Christian who makes it very clear in his own belief system, his own teachings, that on that great day in the morning, the Jews are doomed one way or the other. Either you are doomed as a religion, or you are doomed as a Jew, one way or the other. Because if you don't accept Rick Perry's Redeemer. You will die. And if Rick Perry's standing next to a sword or a gun, he will be the one to kill you. With Christ on his right hand and a Jew on the left, the decision will be very clear. Repent or die. Are you not aware of this? Does Eric Cantor not understand this? Does Charles Schumer not get this? My God. I'll see you tomorrow. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.